Today we're going to talk about yoga. We're going to talk about India also and the origin of yoga. We're going to talk about life, and we're going to talk about anything in between. We are very pleased today to invite Vikramjit Singh with us, who is an Indian teacher from India. He's much more than that. And welcome, Vikramjit, on Sanskriti Radio today. Namaste.
Thank you.
So you are a yoga teacher. You are also, we could say, an influencer in yoga. I've seen that you like to make things straight, to, you know, try to share about what is really yoga. But can you tell us a little bit more about who you are and how did you come into yoga?
Yes. So I was born in New Delhi in India, and growing up, yoga wasn't in India. Definitely not in India the way it's changed over the years, and definitely not what it looks like in the West. It was just something that people did on their own whenever they could, in any way that they could. So my memory of yoga growing up is more ingrained into daily activities of life. You know, no matching clothes, accessories, yoga mats, props, studios, no teachers. I remember back in the day, we didn't have cable. On one of the two channels we had on TV, this gentleman used to be demonstrating yoga at some point, but the yoga that he would be demonstrating...
He's the one from the tea brand, no? The Indian guru, no? Who went on TV.
Yes. What's yes. I'm forgetting his name. I want to say Yoga Brahmachari or something. This is early 80s. So I have this memory of this man sitting in... It's a black and white TV, so no color anyway. This man sitting in what looks like a white robe, big flowing beard. And from what I can remember of that snippet on TV, whenever I would see it, because I wasn't interested in doing that, it was mostly meditation and breathing. You know, now in hindsight, in today's world, I can imagine what he was trying to teach. And my grandfather, whose name is Satya, he would walk me to my bus stop every day till I was in grade 6. And then I left to go to a boarding school. And on the way to the bus stop, he would talk to me about life. He would teach me mantras. He would tell me stories. As a kid, I was really fascinated by mythology, by Puranas or epics, you know, the Ramayana, the Mahabharata. And I would read voraciously. I loved reading all those stories. And even now, when I think back, most of my teaching that I do know about the life lessons from yoga, they kind of touched my life back then, except it wasn't called yoga. It was just life. You know, it was growing up. So that was, you can say, my formal introduction or informal introduction to yoga. And it stayed like that for a very long time in my life. I went to pursue a postgraduate program in Toronto, in Canada. And at the end of the program, I went back to a corporate job. I come from a human resources background. And my boss, my ex-boss, asked me, "Hey, you do yoga, right? You're from India." And I said, "No, I play cricket. That's what we do in India." You know, and she laughed. And she said, "You've never done yoga." And I had a feeling what she was referring to, you know?
Yeah.
I said, "No, I have never done yoga." She said, "You should try it. It's good." So I said, "Okay. You know, the boss has made a recommendation. You have to kind of follow through on that." Imagine. So I looked up, hot yoga is very popular in Canada. You know, it's a cold country. So I looked up studios near me, Bikram and Moksha. Yeah. Yeah, those are the two big names. Bikram, not so much. Moksha has become Moro now.
Oh, okay.
Big in North America. So there was a Moksha studio close to me on the way to work on the subway line. So they had an intro week for $20. So I went, paid my $20, did my first asana class. It was a heated class, primarily a hatha sequence, some pranayama in the beginning, nice long shavasana at the end. I was drenched in sweat. The room must have been at about 38 degrees centigrade, 102 something Fahrenheit. And I fell in love.
Yeah.
And from that day, I went every day. Sometimes I went twice a day.
Yeah.
Somewhere along the line, I did a teacher training with that same group of studios. Quit my job, and at the beginning of 2009 started teaching yoga as a full-time teacher.
In Canada.
I was living in Canada. Yeah, I had said goodbye to India for some time at that point.
Yeah.
Started teaching full-time. And the first few years were just about asana. My own practice was only about asana and my teaching was just about asana. And I think that's very important. I feel that's very important because, at least in my experience, that's the place where one sees progress the fastest. Mm-hmm. That's where you can see very tangible, visible changes, whatever you're looking for, you know, in the realm of physical fitness. And I think that's what motivates people to stay with it, to stick with it. Also, depending on where you're practicing, there's a sense of community. You start getting this feeling that you belong. You know, for me as a new immigrant, I wasn't new to the West, but I was new to Toronto. I didn't know too many people. That also became kind of like a second home for me. I knew the teachers. After some time, I knew fellow practitioners. We were there for the same reason. We would have some tea afterwards, you know, in the lobby. So there was some community building. Fast forward to about 2015 is when I started officially teaching a little bit of philosophy outside of asana, very basic philosophy, some lectures in yoga teacher trainings, some workshops, talking a little bit more to friends, you know, opening the books that I'd bought to look smart that were sitting on my bookshelf for many years, gathering dust. I finally opened them. And fast forward now, I guess today I live in Goa. I've been living here for about 4.5 years. I don't teach any asana. I would love to, but there's no studio culture here. It's a very small town. There's a few places that teach asana classes, but not the way that I'm used to in bigger cities or even smaller cities in the West.
Yeah.
So predominantly my teaching right now revolves around making all this yogic wisdom relevant and applicable. Because for me, the biggest takeaway was not realizing that these things are timeless. They are. I knew them, you know, I'd been exposed to them as a child. But how are they going to play out in my life? And why should I follow them? Or why should I practice them? Or why are they relevant to me? Once I was able to build that connection, it helped me inform my teaching. And like you were saying about the social media piece, it made me realize, what is it that I want to share? So if you were to look back at my feed, for maybe the first couple of years of my life, I was still saying the same things that I'm saying now, but the pictures and the graphics were mostly asana. And then I would say those things. No. So it even made me realize that I don't need that. I don't need to put an asana picture. I can just cut to the chase. I can get to the point and start speaking that message. So yeah, here I am.
And so now you do a lot of online program also from students in Canada also, no? For students living in Canada.
I mostly do online programs. I was doing a lot of retreats in India, but the pandemic put a stop on that. So I'm looking to restart that process again.
Okay.
Some lectures at yoga teacher trainings, sometimes in person, sometimes online. Mostly online courses on Zoom, you know, a setup such as this. It's good. It allows for people to come from different parts of the world, different time zones. When they can't attend live, they can watch a recording. So that definitely has been a blessing of the way we now study yoga.
And I guess since the time of COVID, also people are more sitting at home now. They're more inclined to do, they don't have really much time to do a retreat or to, so they want to have everything at home, you know. I'm not exactly fully for it. I think it's a good way, but it needs to be sometimes matched by a physical presence.
100%. You can never replicate.
Yeah.
You know, you and I, we are having and we will have a meaningful conversation today. But I can tell you, without a doubt, that it would be much more amped up, a lot more meaningful and inspiring if I was sitting across the table from you.
Yeah.
And nothing can ever take that. You know, technology has made our life easy. It's nice. But nothing can take the place of an in-person connection, especially for something in the realm of yoga. One of the reasons I don't teach asana online and I don't practice asana online, because it did not resonate with me. For that, I kept my practice as a self-practice at home for as long as I could. Now I go practice in a shared space. I practice with some friends. And I do a lot of teaching regarding the non-asana piece, but I didn't really get into teaching asana online. Somehow I could not make that connection. You know, after so many years of teaching in person, I could not bridge that gap personally.
Yeah, it's hard. I also struggle sometimes to do this online programs. So you are a yoga teacher, but what is yoga?
It's a $16 billion question. And that's just what they make in North America. That's not counting the rest of the world.
Do you agree that if you know what is yoga, you have to be yoga? To know is to be?
I think there is a lot of wisdom in that question, because it is very important that as a teacher and as a practitioner, that you have a working definition of what is yoga. Because if you don't have a working definition of what is yoga, as a practitioner, you would stumble around, not sure what to do, at some point maybe get bored and go somewhere else. And as a teacher, you would always be in this place of self-doubt, uncertainty, kind of all those things that yoga should take away from your life. So there is a lot of, you know, I jokingly gave you a number, like, you know, that's the money that yoga makes, but yoga can mean a lot of things. You know, historically speaking, in the Sanskrit dictionary, it's the longest entry. It's a 3.5-page entry. Imagine the dictionary font. So imagine how many meanings we can have of yoga, right? Archery, combat, wrestling, lovemaking, perceiving reality. The list is endless.
Yes.
You know, behind me, there's lots of books here, and I could pull out a few books and read you 10 different definitions of yoga.
Yeah.
But those are definitions in a book. Those are definitions that have stood the test of time. They've been around for a very long time. So there must be some truth to them, right?
Yeah.
But what does yoga mean to me will make sure that I practice it. And what does yoga mean to me will define what I teach.
Yes.
And that question, unfortunately, is not asked enough. So I'm glad you asked that. So if you ask me what it means to me, I think the simplest definition I can give you is, yoga to me is a way of perceiving reality.
Yeah, it's very close to my definition. It's very close to my definition, because I would say that right now, because the definition changes as we go, maybe next year if we talk again. But I would say for me, yoga is about knowing the truth, or what is true. So it's similar.
Yeah.
Our definitions.
Yeah. So with that, what I'm hoping to do with that definition is I'm trying to make sense of my reality, and my reality constantly keeps changing.
Yes.
Things in my reality keep changing. So there is almost an unspoken pact that I have told myself that nothing is going to be constant. There is this constant feeling of impermanence. So what this body of wisdom is helping me do is it's helping me perceive that reality as it keeps changing. It's never constant.
But something is not changing, right?
The only thing that's not changing is the impact that this body of wisdom can have. So that body of wisdom is timeless, and we can give it different names.
Yeah.
And we can access that body of knowledge.
Yes. That will not change. But my relationship with constantly keeps changing. You know, I was speaking about my earlier years. I was only interested in the physical aspects of it. I wanted to be really good at the physical pieces of it.
Yeah.
And some part of me still does that. You know, I go practice and I do what my body is capable of that day. But that's not what I'm interested in anymore. Yeah. I'm interested in the stuff that lies beneath now. So that connection, that bond has become a little deeper. So it's not that you stop practicing. You know, I also want to say that while I largely speak about yoga beyond the asana, asana is a prerequisite. Asana gives the discipline.
Yeah.
You have to discipline the body first if you are remotely going to try and discipline the mind.
Mm-hmm.
It can't work the other way around.
Yes, the body is like the first level, and then the mind, and then beyond, maybe.
Yeah, because the body you can bend.
Yeah.
The mind, yeah. Not so much, no. So it's very interesting. I went to your website and I saw just a few things that I think you talk about authenticity And this is something in the last few weeks I've been thinking about. I want to be also pursuing authenticity. And how important is it to you to be authentic? And what does it mean?
At a very fundamental level, right? Sankhya, for example, you know, yogas, we have the sister science, right? So yeah. Sankhya is an intellectual path. You intellectualize your way to freedom, to mukti, nirvana, moksha, whatever you want to call it. Yoga is an embodied practice, abhyasa practice, right? No practice, no yoga, simple. And then we have our own version of what is practice. So right there, if you want to be authentic, you have to be practicing it. And then if you want to be an authentic teacher, you are coming from that place of practice. So that to me is the first caveat for authenticity, that you have a personal connection with the practice and the teaching.
It has to be present.
It has to be present, right?
Yeah.
The second thing I would say is, in today's modern era, and lots of surveys have been done, lots of polls have been done, a lot of studies have been done, the most common goals that people associate with yoga are better health, less stress, better life choices. You know, these are some of the widely chosen parameters that people say that yoga is bringing to them. But when I look back at some of the texts that I've read, whatever little studies I've done, there is a different common theme there. That common theme there is that I am not this limited being that I think I am. I am covered by a veil of ignorance, and that veil of ignorance is so strong that it does not allow me to see my true self, my true divinity. There is someone up there around me who is a much larger force than me. Who is that person? And what is my relationship with that person? So loosely speaking, these are some themes that I see running across different yoga schools. And by yoga schools, I mean yoga traditions, yoga texts, yoga lineages, right? Who is Ishvara? What is my relationship with Ishvara? Who am I? What is this world around me? What is my relationship with this world? So if you see, we have two very different themes: health, wellness, less stress, mental health, and then these bigger existential questions. To me, it is possible for these to coexist. It is possible in a modern yoga world, in a modern postural yoga world, they can live hand in hand. And to me, that is the second benchmark of authenticity, is if you can bring together modern day goals with traditional goals of yoga and create some sort of a joint container. You know, the time that those texts were written was very different from the time that we live in. So I get it, you know, better sleep, better food choices, better health. Those are almost a prerequisite. Yeah. So let's keep them. But can we also go a little bit deeper towards these bigger questions, which is what this path is supposed to provide guidance for? And, you know, interestingly, one of the definitions is union, right? Can we bring them together? Can we unite these? Because they have been united. Even if I look at the medieval period, like they say, the 12th century to the 18th century, the rise of the Hatha yoga, right? Extreme bodily purifications. Even then, the top tier goal, you know, the Pradipika calls it Raja Yoga. We can call it Raja Yoga, Samadhi, whatever you want to call it. That was still the top goal.
Yeah.
Even after putting your body through all of those intense physical maneuvers, that's where the practitioner was hoping to land.
Mm.
So as a modern day practitioner, I may or may not be looking for samadhi. I might not even know what is samadhi. I may have zero interest in achieving samadhi. Yeah. So that doesn't need to be the benchmark anymore. But can we have a deeper, meaningful question about one's purpose, existence, relationship with themselves, with the world around them, with the people around them, while they do this very physical practice? Can we bring the two of them together?
Yes.
You know, that to me is the second benchmark of what I would call as authentic yoga. And I say authentic yoga because nowadays it gets tossed around with everything, right? Everything is authentic yoga.
Yeah. Everybody thinks
putting a label on it, you know.
Yeah. I like something you said also. You said yoga is for everyone, but as a yoga teacher, you cannot teach everyone, and that's okay. Can you tell us more about this? Because I like that.
Yeah. You know, times are not as simple as they used to be, fortunately or unfortunately, right? The method of teaching is not as simple as it used to be, right? Right from Zoom to technology to this wide, diverse world we live in. I always see amongst teachers, you know, I hear these conversations, people speak to me, I look at my own experience. It's practically impossible in this lifetime, in this lifetime, even though I've been studying for a while, I'll study till my time is up. I will barely scratch the surface, like such a tiny scratch that you won't be able to see the scratch. So that's the extent of this body of knowledge.
Yeah.
You know? So understanding that there's no way I can study all of it. Subsequently, there's no way I can understand all of that. Subsequently, there's no way I can teach all of that.
Mm.
So avoid the traps of social media where you look at someone who's doing something and you find that enamoring or you find that attractive and you're like, oh, why don't I teach that? Why don't I teach this? Why don't I teach this? Why don't I teach that?
Yeah.
Not really needed. Let them find the teachers who are teaching what they're looking to learn. Because there's enough practitioners and there's enough teachers, right?
Yeah.
So I think making peace with that fact is also, and I'm glad you asked that question right after the first one. To me, that's also a mark of authenticity.
Yeah.
You know, if I quickly go do some 1 hour workshop and then hold a workshop on that, just because it's a popular topic.
Yeah, it's not in your heart. You're not really embodying it.
It's not exactly. It's not coming from a place of embodiment.
Yeah.
As teachers, we also need to recognize that we will not be able to teach everybody.
Yeah. And not everyone is ready also for it. Not everyone is ready for it.
Yes. Great point.
Like, just like the last time, 2 weeks ago, we had a student who came here and it was a woman. And in the first class, spontaneously, we started talking about philosophy. And it went deep. But she was in a very dark place, this woman. And right away she said, oh, I didn't come here for that. I came here just to do asana. I just want to do yoga, she said. But for her, yoga means asana. And this made me think a lot that that she doesn't want more. Right now she just wants the basic. And some people don't want to feel better also right away. They don't want to change their life too quickly, I feel. They want it to be slow and they're okay with, because they are familiar with the way their life are, you know, revealed. And they don't want this to change too fast. They prefer the misery of their present moment because they know and they're comfortable with it rather than going too fast. But me as a person, as a yoga aspirant, I want it to go fast. I'm ready for change. And so that way also it's difficult to tailor to everyone's needs. And but hopefully she will hit it and she will, yeah.
I was going to say, I taught for so many years in a studio setting, right? There's 30 bodies in there, sometimes more, more people in there.
Yeah.
It's a 60-minute hatha class or a 60-minute vinyasa class, right?
Mm.
So in that moment, I have come to hold space for the people in the class to help them move intelligently, safely, with their breath, so that for that 60 minutes, they're fully present and aware of the connection of their body and their mind. Mm. That's how I always saw my role as a teacher, as an asana teacher. I'm here to hold space and create awareness for people. You know, you've been teaching for a while. It's not a given that everyone is aware of how to link their movements and their breath. It takes time. It takes practice.
Mm-hmm.
It takes a lot of time. And then takes a whole lot of practice to keep your mind and not let your body go on autopilot when you've been practicing for a while. You know, when you've been practicing for a while, you're open, stretchy, bendy. You can hold a pose and you're sitting in the Himalayas in your mind, right? Just your physical body is in the class. So that's a whole other conversation. So yeah, I respect that. And I'm glad that woman shared that, because I have been that practitioner. I was very interested in testing my physical endurance for the 60 minutes. I wasn't interested in chanting or in pranayama or anything like that, you know? So yeah, that's a good container. But I will say that also, you know, then my job is as a purely asana teacher is to create a container of awareness. So I'm not a big fan of external distractions, loud music, gadgets, gimmicks. Then that takes the person away.
Yeah.
You know, I look at just like I can say that, oh, philosophy might be a distraction for someone. They just want to be in their body right now.
Yeah.
Well, so are the other things too, right? So then let's work on that. If our intent is to create a space where bodies can learn to move intelligently and synchronize with their breath, then let's do that. Let's minimize the distractions.
That's true. So as a yoga teacher, it's about also adapting your excitement, your passion. And because sometimes you want to share, but there's no one on the other end who wants to receive. So it's about being patient, and everyone is going their own speed. So that's a learning progress for me.
Say that at the end of class, I always give these practical suggestions. At the end of class, you can give someone like a little piece of paper, say, here's some podcast whenever you get a chance. Here's a book that I read. If you ever feel like,
yeah, just like,
you know, that's how I bought my first. Yeah. Someone just said, hey, you should, you've been practicing yoga. You would love this book. And I bought that book. And I didn't read it for a while, but at some point I did pick it up. I did read it. So.
Yeah, I understand that.
So
how do you, because I see you are, you have quite a bit of followers, and you have to, you know, it's like your students, and they are hungry to know more every day and to let you share your wisdom and your knowledge. But I see you have a daughter also. Well, how difficult is it to balance this digital life, the yoga life, the learning one, and the family life? Is it a daily struggle?
It's hard. It's definitely hard. But I try and practice what I preach. You know, if I'm gonna foster a sense of awareness and mindfulness, then I want to carry it into all aspects of my life.
Yeah.
So I try and work my schedule in such a manner that the two, unless it's absolutely necessary, don't conflict with each other.
Yes.
You know, simple example is, I know I had a few hours free right now, so this makes sense.
Yeah.
Even though she could be in a different room, my daughter could be in a different room, but I want to be present with her when she's around, you know, just like I want to be present with my practice when I'm practicing. And of course, you try and find a balance, right? Sometimes, you know, she has sat in the back of a shala with her iPad watching her show while I did my practice, because that was the only way. So we've also done that, you know.
Yeah, and she will also be inspired, not only because you are present with her, but also because she will realize how passionate you were all these years working. So that's also an inspiration for us.
Absolutely. A lot of times, sometimes it happens if I'm doing a lecture at night and she's awake, or I'm doing it early morning and she got out of bed and she came. I let her come and sit behind me and she listens. You know, it's interesting. She's named after my grandfather. Her name is Satya, and my grandfather's name was Satya.
Yeah, truth.
Truth, exactly. Yeah. So that's how I learned from him. He did not ask me to sit down and open a notebook and ask me to take notes. He just spoke to me. I was around that. And it was getting embedded somewhere in the subconscious. And it took 20 years for that switch to be turned on.
Yes.
But similarly, you know, it's around my daughter. She can hear it. She sees it. She had a little talent show at her school. She just went to grade two at the end of her grade one talent show. So she and I did like a little yoga show.
Yes, I saw it online. It's nice.
Yeah, we did some poses.
Yeah.
So, you know, it's something around her.
She's how old?
She'll be 7 in October.
Ah, just like my daughter. So she was born in 2017.
2017, correct.
Yeah, so they're the same age.
Yeah.
So one day when we come to Kerala, maybe we can meet.
Yes, please, 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 please bring her to Goa. I would love for Satya to...
Yeah, we were there 2 years ago in Goa. I enjoyed it. It was right at that time when it was getting hot also. Just before, I think, some April or May or something. So I want to talk about cultural appropriation. Because I'm not completely convinced by it. And maybe today you can convince me. Because I feel, in a way, you should respect... for example, yoga, let's take yoga as an example. It comes from India. Sometimes students don't even know that yoga comes from India. But at the same time, I don't think we should be upset if people are doing some of it, but they don't do all, because it should, like, I feel we could also decide how we react. And we can decide to be also proud that people are taking yoga, and even if they don't really fully understand it. Like recently, there was a video on YouTube. And it was this American who was wearing a very stereotypical costumes of Chinese and of, I don't know if you saw that video, of Indians. And they would go around in this university and say, with the costume, no? And talk to students, do you find this inappropriate? And everybody was like, yeah, it's so inappropriate, you're making fun of them, and you should not wear this, it's a shame. And everybody was talking about the same thing, the same students, the 20-year-old, the 18-year-old, the 16-year-old. And then he would go to Chinatown with the same costume, and all the Chinese would say, well, I like it, it's very nice, and they don't feel offended by it. Like, what is your opinion about cultural appropriation, and what is your point of view?
So see, I speak a lot about that, and I also do courses, do workshops. I speak a lot about that. When speaking about yoga, it's practically impossible to separate culture and history of India from the culture. There is no yoga culture. That's a made up term. You know, yoga doesn't have a culture. It's a body of knowledge. You know, like, what about Sankhya? What's Sankhya culture? Or what's Vedanta culture? We just pick yoga because it's the most popular, right? Yeah. So I find it strange when people say yoga culture. India has a culture because it's a country, like, you know, French culture, Swiss norms, French norms, whatever the case may be. Yoga has a history and India has a history. But it's impossible to extrapolate the culture and the history of India outside of yoga because they're so entwined. So that's where it gets a little tricky.
Yeah.
I'll give you a good example. If someone was to put the symbol Om on a yoga mat, right, doesn't matter where, that will seem offensive to some people because for them that symbol is a form of divinity.
Yeah.
And the reason why I say Om, let's say Om, the symbol Om, why I say that is because, you know, everyone reads the Yoga Sutras, right? So technically, in the Yoga Sutras, the closest Patanjali comes to describing Ishvara is the Pranava Om. That is the Purusha Viveka, that is the omnipresent. And it's there, you know, in the Mandukya, in other Upanishads. It is a revered symbol.
Yeah.
Right? Also, in Indian culture, or South Asian culture, subcontinent culture, your feet, because they walk on the floor.
Yeah.
Do not need to be on the same, should not come in contact with things that you rever. So, for example, no books in my house on the floor.
Yes.
Books are on the shelf.
Yes. Like for my wife, she taught me this. Like, I was not like this, but if a book fell on the floor and I was walking, I would maybe push it with my feet or something. And for her, it was like, no, don't touch. It's a god. I forgot the name of that. Yes. It's Sarasvati, don't touch with your feet. And after a while, she trained me, and now I would never touch a book with my feet.
So that's the reason I say that is Henna, Mandy,
yes,
Bindi. wearing Indian clothes. To me, that's not appropriation, because there is nothing wrong about, you know, I'm wearing a t-shirt. Are t-shirts native to India? I don't know.
Yeah, okay.
You know, am I offending someone by wearing a regular round neck t-shirt? I don't think so, you know?
Yeah.
So making the distinction between very external, shallow representation and deep symbolism.
Yeah. So it's a discernment.
And I think that can only come, I think the big missing piece in cultural appropriation is understanding that unless you have a relationship with something, it will always be very superficial. I'll give you another example. I love Hanuman, for example, you know, but I don't wear any t-shirts of Hanuman. And the reason why I don't is very practical. It's because A, that t-shirt will get dirty, will go in a hamper where there's other dirty clothes. That t-shirt at some point will get old and frayed, and I'll feel really bad about throwing it in the garbage because it's got Hanuman on it.
Yeah.
So I have other ways to show my love and respect for that person that I have a relationship with. There is a relationship. There is some reverence. There is some love. So I move from that lens.
Yeah.
Right? Now, let's go to the hybrid yoga scene. Bear yoga, goat yoga, naked yoga, ganja yoga, whatever yoga, right? Something yoga. It's interesting. It's interesting because to me, that someone devised a good way, a quick way to get people together.
Yeah. So it's not all negative. It's not completely negative, but it's not very profound. Is that what you mean? Like,
I'll tell you what'll happen. What I've seen happen in most cases is it's not sustainable. You can't do it every day, right? So it becomes an event. It becomes something that you do once in a while. It's something that you pay extra money for. And and after some time, that's the only way that you do it.
Yeah.
A lot of times people will tell me that, oh, it's not bad. It at least got people on the mat. It only got people on the mat on that day. What about when the event got over? Did they come back and take a regular class? Did someone follow up with them and say, hey, you came for this wine yoga. Now we have boring old-fashioned yoga in the studio at 6 p.m. Would you like to buy a 10-class pass? Would you like to join a month's membership?
Yeah.
I have met no one who took one of these event classes and got converted to yoga. Because what they experienced, unfortunately, was a lot of fun and community building, but was missing the essence.
Yes, and it might just put them off for yoga altogether afterward.
Yeah. So to me, I don't get really upset when I see that happen. I'm like, all right, you know, someone's, I don't know, trying to do something with it. It's mostly monetary. It doesn't come out of the goodness out of someone's heart. It's very monetary. It happens because someone would like to make something out of it and link it in such a manner. So yeah, so I don't, you know, that kind of stuff doesn't upset me. I think it is a reality. But I also tell people, I said, I'll just say one thing. That is not yoga. That's an event. That's an experience. That's something that had accessories, which made it fun. It had a start time. It had an end time. You know, definition-wise, yoga is both a goal and a state. I am working towards the goal of yoga while I'm in the state of yoga. I laugh when people say, I'm going to yoga.
Yes.
You're in yoga right now.
Yes.
You're going to go to a class and move your body from 6 to 7 p.m. or whatever time.
Yes.
But it's all around you.
It reminds me of a woman who, she had one more class on the cart. It was just before the summer holidays. And we are open during summer. But I said, you came back. She said, yeah, I had one more class. But this summer, I won't be coming because, you know, I have so many things. But I'll be coming in September. And I told her, are you telling me that for the whole summer, you don't want to be present? And this is what I felt from her. It's like, right now, I don't want to be aware of myself. I just want to do things. Because people are afraid of loneliness. There's a tension inside and they'd rather do something, go somewhere, talk to someone, or organize a travel or something, because they feel uneasy inside. So I told her, you don't want to be present. for the whole holidays.
I think things are becoming more apparent and clear. I feel that things haven't been very clear. There's things have been happening in small pockets. So unless they happen to you, no one knew about it. I'll give you a perfect example. I think we are of the same generation, same age group-ish. Before the pandemic, I had never seen a collective global suffering. You know, I grew up in India. People are like, oh, there's poverty in India. There is poverty in Africa. This is happening there in small pockets. For those 2 years, everyone's experience was different, but the whole world shut down. No one was excluded from that suffering. Sure, depending on who you were, what privilege you have, what power you had, lifestyle, all that stuff, your experience was different. Your suffering intensity was different. But in my lived experience so far, that was the first time, collective. Yeah. You know, there was no country that said, oh, this doesn't impact us.
Yeah.
So that's what I think is happening now is the pockets aren't small anymore. It's almost like a forest fire that's spreading. So I hate to sound so morbid, but there's like a global inferno. Mm-hmm. Everything is aflame.
Yeah.
And that unfortunately seems to be not someone's reality. It seems to be our collective reality. Again, there is a lot of difference, especially here in India. You've been here. The difference between the have and the have-nots is very drastic here compared to mm-hmm. other places where I've lived, you know? So I think what's happening is we are living in this time where everyone's reality more or less looks the same. You don't have to be living in some third world country in some corner of the world to suffer. Big cities, superpowers, cosmopolitan cities. You know, I see some pictures of San Francisco or other big cities, you know, where there's food shortage, unemployment, things that you would not associate with these powerful countries or these big developed cities.
Yes. And actually, here I'm, you would be happy to know that here I'm a defender of India. So, because I feel very close to India. So I feel that when I was talking about India, people have this idea because here on TV, you only show the stereotype of India. India is poor. So I was always trying to defend India in a way. And what I was often saying is right now, India is richer than France. If you add, and you're like, oh yeah, really? In what way? And I was saying always, if you add all the categories, social, cultural, even economical right now in a way, and all the different categories, family life. If you add everything at the end, India is richer than France right now. And people are very surprised by this, but I saw it in India. Sometimes you would see somebody who seems poor, but what is disturbing for the Westerners is that actually you're looking at somebody who is poorer than you, but it seems more at peace within. And the Westerner is there in India traveling and has, you know, a lot of anxiety, went to see already a psychiatrist and probably has antidepressants in the backpack and all this. And you're looking at somebody who is who looks very poor, but is okay with the situation. And I think this is what people were saying. Oh, in India, you might be shocked by the poverty or the things. But I was shocked when I came back to France, actually. Because the misery in France is not as clear with your eyes, but it's more like loneliness. People don't cook so much anymore. They don't have any spiritual connection. There is no God. There is no religion. So it's like a materialistic world. And there's many more diseases that you don't even know in India. And burnout. Like in India, there's maybe night starting, the burnout concept. But in India, the man who is working every day and you look at him and you're like, you feel bad for him because his work seems very hard. There's no burnout in his mind. So there is no burnout in his reality. But he is. So did you witness this in Canada also? This gap?
It's changed a lot. You know, I haven't lived there for 4.5 years, but I can see each time I visit, I can see there's a difference. You know, the Canada, at least from an immigrant's perspective, from an outsider's perspective, seemed this booming, prosperous, very happy, very loving, very very non-confrontational, you know, very peace-loving. But I've seen a shift there too, you know, I've seen a huge shift there too. The big difference is that in India, there is a natural acceptance towards life. No one has to convince you about the concept of karma or destiny or fate. It's ingrained in you. It's part of your fabric. It's part of your being. So there is a general acceptance towards what life is bringing. And then you learn to make the most of it. You learn to make the best of it. And that, I think, is a nuance only someone who either is born and lived here or has lived here for some time will fully grasp and understand.
Yes, it makes you more in acceptance with life and makes you more humble also. And you just see, like in India, you see sometimes on the side of the road some people who have like had polio. And I remember in Rishikesh you would see a few of them, but they would not have this anger or the hate, like the jealousy or the thing. They just accept that in this life, maybe I manifested this because I wanted maybe to feel this, so I'm okay with it. And I don't hold any grudge against you because you seem to be healthier or richer than me. It's okay. This is my experience. And this is, I think this is what disturbs the most Westerners when they go to India.
Yeah, I agree.
So very interesting conversation. I don't know if you could share also a little bit about how people can find about you and what you have to share.
I love talking about all things yoga. So obviously, I'll be there on Instagram sharing anything that I can. Outside of that, there's a website that's linked to it. You can find me on the website. I offer online courses. If you want to study with me, and retreats in India. Yeah, that's in the near future. I would like to offer a yoga teacher training program. Working on that.
And when are you going back? When are you coming to Europe next? You should come and visit us.
Actually, in the summer months, I would love to come visit, bring my daughter,
yes,
have her experience the beauty, be outside, teach, connect with a like-minded community.
You are welcome here anytime, and it would be a pleasure to have you here.
So much.
So thank you very much, and we can maybe plan the second one and go deeper.
Yeah, anytime you want. Don't have to ask me twice to talk about yoga.
Thank you so much, and see you next time. Au revoir. Thank you. Bye bye. See you.